All right, so we're recording. Okay, good morning and welcome to this edition of the Richard Urban Show. I'm your host, Richard Urban, coming to you from Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. Today, we're very happy to have on a candidate for the Supreme Court of Appeals in West Virginia, Jim Douglas. And we'll ask you to just introduce yourself and maybe say anything you want about yourself or your family, and we'll take it from there.
All right, ahead. Very well. My name is Jim Douglas. I'm currently family court judge in Kanawha County. Before I became judge for 39 and a half years, I was a divorce lawyer and had one little stint as prosecuting attorney in Braxton County. I'm a native West Virginian. I'm a Braxton County native. That's Sutton for all you people in Eastern Panhandle. Flatwoods area. Everybody's come down I-79's come through Braxton County at one time or another. I am nobody special, as Don Nealon used to say at WVU. I was raised in Clay County, just below the Braxton County line. Went to Clay County High School. I'm 69 years old, so I guess that qualifies me as older than dirt, or at least dust, anyway.
Okay.
And there's at least two other people running in these Supreme Court races the older I am, so I take some gratification from that. I graduated from University of Charleston, which used to be Morse Harvey College in those days in Charleston. In 1973, the year of Yom Kippur and Watergate, and also the beginnings of the gas shortage, if you all remember. And then I graduated from WU with a master's in 1975 and then a law degree from WU in 1977. Like I said, I was prosecuting attorney in Braxton County.
Okay.
I think people need to know that I have been and am a parent. Okay, I have three kids, one who is an assistant United States attorney in Wheeling, Jared. I have a daughter that's a paralegal for HCA. It's a hospital, used to be called the HCCRA, Cost Containment Authority. And I have a son that's a doctor in Lewisburg in Greenbrier County. And my daughter-in-law, his wife, is a doctor, is a physician as well. And I have six grandchildren.
Wow, that's great.
One of which... Yeah, a grandson was born, the first grandson that was born, there was an older grandson, but the first one was born of the last of the six, and he was born on January 3rd in Wheeling, so I haven't had too much of a chance to see him, and I am divorced. You don't see too many people running for office that say that, but I am divorced. So as far as family law matters, I've lived them. I've sat where a lot of people that I sit in judgment on every day have been, so I can identify with those problems. I've served two terms on the West Virginia State Bar Board of Governors. I've served two terms as chair of the Family Law Committee of the West Virginia State Bar. I have argued over 40 cases to the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals, mostly divorce and family law cases. I've also tried family law cases and other cases in 44 of the state's 55 counties. So I've done, even though I've been primarily a divorce lawyer in my career, I've tried every case that's imaginable. I've tried condonations, boundary lines, slip and fall. I've tried paternity actions, which of course is a family law issue. I have tried car wrecks. I've done adverse possession claims. That's a bunch of lawyer talk where people come in and try to take your property because they occupy it for no other reason. And various civil litigation issues, wrongful discharge cases, I don't want to say the word, you know. I mean, I have a plethora of experience, practical experience, and that I think argues well in favor of me. I was also legal coordinator for RESA 4 in West Virginia back in the 80s, which I had a good exposure to special education law, among other things. I've been a litigator in various election contests over the years. Central West Virginia, where I grew up, is a hotbed for, conscientious, but also very intense election contest. So at any rate, that's that's pretty much my history in a nutshell.
So there were some contested elections that came before you.
Well, not before me. I participated in as an attorney. And then also, and one was mine, that when I won prosecuting attorney in 1984 in Braxton County, I won by one vote. Everybody says, you know, my vote doesn't count. I am the textbook example of that.
The last thing I'd say is,
that's true. It went into the canvas and recounts. The election in those days were in June. It was up in latter August before we got it decided. And the other thing I'm very proud of is my participation in West Virginia Symphony Orchestra. I've been with them 7 years. I've been on the board of directors, been officer for 11 years. So 7 years I was in another function. But nevertheless, I've been affiliated 11 years with Symphony Orchestra, which I like very much. Other than that, I'm just an average Joe.
Okay. So
no family money.
Yeah. So what would you say? You've given a lot of experience you've had in, you know, family court and other, types of courts. What would you say are the main, three main reasons or the main reasons you're running, like, for the Court of Appeals, particularly? The Supreme Court of Appeals.
Well, I'm in Division II, and that's the open seat. Justice Workman's not running in, so there's no incumbent on it, okay? The main reason I can say that I'm running right now, if I were to ask you, Richard, and your listeners, or the people following on video, for you to imagine, sir, you're in your circle of acquaintances and your friends and family, don't answer the question, but just form the answer in your mind. How many people do you know that's had an association with a felony in your recent years? Okay, you're going to have a number maybe come to your mind. Most statistics show, though, that if you have some encounter with the law any time in your life, if you leave out vehicular offenses like speeding and that type of thing, it's going to be a family law case. So then my second part of that question would be, in your circle of friends, your circle of acquaintances, how many people do you know that's been in a divorce, child custody fight, grandparent visitation, LGBTQ litigation, relocation, paternity action, abuse, neglect? I venture to say that number is quite a bit higher, at least in my experience, mm-hmm. people that you know. So my point is family law situations touch everyone. It is like the virus. It is the great equalizer. Your affluence, your name, your pedigree, your sex, your gender preference, or your political affiliations mean nothing. You have, if you're exposed to the virus, you could contract it. Same way about it. All those same factors militate into saying this, that family law touches all of us in all respects, irrespective of person, without regard to person in any way, shape, or form. And and that's part of the reason I'm running. I am the only candidate that has substantial family law experience. I'm talking about substantial. I'm talking about over, including my term as family court judge, over 43 years. Right now on the Supreme Court of Appeals, right now, this second, as you and I draw breath in our respective counties, there are three justices on that Supreme Court right now that have never picked a jury, never cross-examined a witness, never presented an indictment, never ran a law office as a principal, never even argued a case as first chair in front of the Supreme Court they now sit on. And what's even worse, four out of the five, and then it depends on who gets elected in Justice Workman's seat, four out of the five have never tried a grandparent case from beginning to end, tried a half a dozen divorce cases. And then among all the candidates, there's two that's got in the other, one in the other division, one in my division, has had some exposure to it, but nobody's had the experience that I've had. And those 40 plus cases I've argued to the Supreme Court, the majority of those being family. Bottom line is, this family law needs a representative on the Supreme Court. And that is further supported by some statistics I can give you. If you go to the Supreme Court's website, don't take my word for it. In 2017, 64% of all civil appeals that were filed in the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals were family law. In 2018, again, 64% of all civil appeals filed in the Supreme Court were family law. In 2019, it slipped a little bit, but it's still more than half. 58.5% of all cases filed in the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals were family law cases. If you look in, if you look at everything that was filed in the Supreme Court, in 2018, there were 332 domestic relations cases filed in the Supreme Court, but only 228 criminal cases. Everybody thinks that's the number one thing. Family law is the most of any cases filed in the Supreme Court. 2019, still the trend was there. 304 domestic relations cases versus 220 criminal cases. Okay. That was the next one.
So yeah, let me jump in if I might interject. Yeah, so thanks for sharing your experience, which is important. Do you support, like, so you've been doing family law, and do you support, like, the idea of community marriage policies? Have you heard about that? Where, you know, in certain cities and jurisdictions, primarily cities, I believe, they would make a policy among the clergy, you know, that to get married, you have to have some counseling or some kind of a course. Do you think that's a good idea, a bad idea? Why or why not?
Well, now I got to make clear, the Canada Judicial Ethics say I can't comment on a case that may come in front of me. But there's also a White versus Minnesota case decided by the United States Supreme Court. It says I can comment on issues if there's not a current case in front of the West Virginia Supreme Court.
Well, I was talking about a case so much, just like about the idea of community marriage policies. You know what I mean?
Here's my feeling on it. I'm going to be upfront with you about it. Is if you will look in my history, in 2005, I took a case to the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals, and it was the first case involving a same-sex custody. In other words, it was a lesbian custody case, which I won against a biological grandfather. It's called Clifford K. versus Smar, S-M-A-R-R. It was 2005. Nobody would take that case but me. I took it up, lost it at the circuit court level, won it at the Supreme Court level. Now nobody thinks about those things. And here's my position. I've got a stepson, I guess, because I mean, I'm not married, but my partner has a son that is openly gay, and I went to his wedding. I perform regularly. I'm the only family court judge that regularly performs gay weddings in Kanawha County, state of West Virginia. My feeling is you shouldn't have to impose, I'm answering your question now, you shouldn't have to impose additional obligations upon anyone that wants to enter into a non-traditional or gay marriage. The Obergefell decision and the Windsor decision that both came out of the United States Supreme Court says we don't treat anybody differently. Nobody's going to make, I can remember when I got married in 1976, nobody made me go to any kind of counseling or anything. We just showed up, did the blood test, went to the preacher, got it done.
Yeah.
I don't think you should impose that on any group, any particular group.
I think, go ahead.
Well, I may have offended you or a number of
people. No, you're saying. So I think, I was thinking of it more, I see what you're saying. So it's not a legal covenant, it's among churches. So I was looking at their website, like Marriage Savers. So I think it is like the churches agree. So I think if you choose to be married elsewhere, it has no effect. It's not, I don't think it can be. I agree with you. It can't be like legal, you know. Hey, you want to get married, you must take this course. No, but I think what it is that the churches in particular communities, like one I think that's been pretty successful is Kansas City, Kansas. They say they make some agreement. So presumably a same-sex couple just wouldn't go to any of those churches. They would just go through a justice of the peace and do whatever they want. So I don't think it would really affect that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, right. Well, let me come back then. I see more clearly your question now. Right now, and I'm a member of the Christ Church United Methodist in Charleston. And of course, we have openly gay members and even some, and even teachers. The issue that's confronting us right now is, one, can there be gay clergy? Okay. And two, can there be gay weddings within the church itself? And there's been quite a bit of fracturing, even among the like three different views in the Methodist charge. And in our church, it's been divisive. It hasn't been decided. And I think, you know, when I'm a Christian by religion, and I believe whenever, you know, Christ said, come unto me all, you know, that whomsoever comes, that they come. I don't think there should be any the churches shouldn't impose that on anyone. If you want to be a member, when Christ said whomsoever, he didn't have a asterisk above the R and
okay.
Something in the footnote.
Yeah, well, that's clear, a clear answer. I appreciate that. Yeah. So, that's very, very, very important. To kind of change the topic a little, you know, what would be your view of the, like, whole 2018, you know, impeachment of the West Virginia Supreme Court? Do you think that the legislature, like, overreached, or was it appropriate, or just what's your view on what was going on there and since then?
Well, no, we've had some fallout from that. I mean, of course, the impeachments are over, but I think two things came out of this that are still with us. One is there has been a dilution of the separation of powers by the case. It was called Workman versus Carmichael. That's where the impeachment of the proceedings against Justice Workman. She filed suit, recused herself, all the other justices, well, they weren't sitting or they were recused. And she appointed five judges and they said, all right, legislature, you can't be doing this because of certain procedures. Now, it's going to be strange to hear somebody in the judicial section say what I'm going to say. It would sound like I'm actually in the legislature. But I think that the case that was overruled to get to that point to stop the proceedings against Workman were ill-advised. I think the legislature can't be interfered with in their lawful execution of their constitutional duties. In fact, the 10 years before that Workman case in 2008, I think it's 10 years, there was what was called the Clodges case, where there was an attempt made to make the legislature, it had to do with an expungement of a gentleman on a drug charge and expungement of his record, to have that expungement appear in the official record of the Senate and the House. And the Supreme Court at that time, 2008, said we can't interfere with the legislature. If they want to do that, they want to do it. So the Workman case comes along and reverses that. And I think there's been a diminution of the separation of powers with regard to the legislature. I don't think the legislature should have been limited on that. Now, to hear a judge say that, that's trying to get on the Supreme Court, is probably atypical, I would say. The second thing that's left out, that's left on the impeachment process, of course, everybody had their favorites on that. I felt it was pretty badly, in my mind, the worst offense to me was, and I'm speaking out, I know I might end up on the court with her, but that was Justice Walker, outsourcing her opinions to be written outside of the Supreme Court and paid for it. You know, I like to think my experience, by George, I'll write my own opinions. And then they have at the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals four clerks. Now, if you're from the D.C. area, if you check the United States Supreme Court, each one of the nine justices of the United States Supreme Court only have three clerks. West Virginia's five, each has four clerks.
Wow.
And it looks to me like between Justice Walker and four of her clerks, they might have been able to turn out an opinion. I'll write my own. But one of the other, and you know, that was never really dealt with. There's one more, I guess, residual issue too on this, Richard, is, as you well know, the upshot of all these efforts or all these, offenses by the Supreme Court at that time, real or imagined, was that they lost the power to set their own budget. The legislature does that now, and there's been, I guess, a certain decrying of judicial figures saying, oh, woe is me, that shouldn't happen. To me, that is a golden opportunity. If you follow the West Virginia legislature this year about this foster care funding and the ups and the downs and the throes and the woes of that, and the, whether there's money in it and the politics involved in it. I say put a line item in the budget. There's only 9 items in the Supreme Court's budget. Put another line item in to fund foster families. Put another line item in to the fund guardians ad litem who represent kids and custody issues. I say put another line item funded to give some stipends to guardians. That's usually grandparents that come in and have to get a guardianship over their kid, grandkids, because right. their kids are addicted. I say put a line item in there to provide daycares at the various courthouses. So when people come to family court, they got a place to bring their kids. I have it happen to me all the time. People have nowhere to take their kids. They bring it into the courtroom because they just don't have any way. And I think also there'll be funding for Saturday courts, at least family courts, at least one time a month, so people don't have to miss work. What I'm saying is you don't have to go back to the legislature like on foster care family funding every year, hat in hand, asking for money or trying to keep the money you got or trying to expand the program or somebody kind of trying to contract. Put it in the budget and then they can pass on it at that point in time as a package. That makes, you know, it's such an opportunity. I hate to use the same word twice. It's just an unbelievable event that we should be taking advantage of. But that's what I see the leftover from the impeachment series. Mm-hmm. I talk too much. My passion comes through for family law, and I won't apologize for it.
So the foster care budget would be set by the legislature, but you feel that it should be more. There should be more funding for things like, I noticed that on your website too, like guardian ad litems and right. Some other services, like you mentioned, that would support foster families, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's the number one thing. That and guardian ad litem funding, I think, are the two major ones. You know, if you have, as I said, if you have that in the budget as part of your budget, one, that allows you know to make that presentation even handily, but it keeps the Supreme Court in control of it. You give it to the legislature, they're a macrocosm of the society, or a microcosm, if you look at it. A lot of them haven't had family law experience, but they've had family experience, like divorces and grandparents and that type
You're
of thing.
You're saying, so the Supreme Court was, so that amendment changed it, right? So the legislature is more in control of the budget. So you're saying Absolutely. Some of that should be shifted back to the Supreme Court?
Like No, I'm not. I don't have a position on that. I mean, that's constitutional amendments. Right. I'm saying now that we get to present our budget, include these things in the budget.
Okay.
Rather than bragging, I know that Justice Armstead went down and then I was in a forum the other night, was bragging how they cut it down 10% last year and something like 8% from the preceding year. To me, I'm not sure that's a brag. I think that there's a lot of things going wanting, like guardian ad litem funding of foster families, but that stuff back in the budget.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. Okay, so a question, like in the long term, it seems like, we've seen a great growth throughout the nation in West Virginia of the foster care system the last, 3 or 4 decades, I guess? What do you think? Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. No, I'm sorry.
Say, what would be the long-term solution? Like, do you see that just increasing? Or could we be doing some things, sort of like I was referring to the marriage policy, or, our organization works with, youth education? Hey, if more people get married, they don't maybe cohabit, they have kids in marriage, that might help. What do you think about that? What would be a long-term view of what can we do in the long term?
Well, I think in the long term, I think the increase in foster families and children that are victims, they're victims of the opioid crisis and addiction. And I think how we approach that is, one, we try to, of course, I mean, there's all kinds of things like, recovery programs that I think have their place. But also, I think the courts, by, budgetary inclusion, have to put more money into foster funding, because that has increased, foster families have increased in, I think, geometrically in the last 3 years, probably, or 4 years. And that is a direct result of, I think, the opioid crisis. Now, one of the other ways we can address that is, too, going after doctors who write these prescriptions that they shouldn't be writing, or mid-levels, or the pill manufacturers. But on the other end, and keep the recovery programs in place. But I think the other way to address it is to provide greater funding for subsidized adoptions for a while, anyway, till we see how it works out. And what that means is right now there's, when I quit practicing, of course, this is 5 years ago, there was like a $400 subsidy for an adoption for a family. If the parents were guilty of abuse and neglect, or they had abandoned children, or they abused children, sex abuse, something like that, and that parental rights terminated, that's where a lot of the foster families come in. Because, see, the policy law, Richard, is to reunite families. You go to foster families when parental rights have been terminated. You just don't go there where somebody maybe had excessive discipline on a child and there's a parenting plan in place and an improvement period. Those kids go back eventually to their parents. It's the ones that have been terminated. And I think we have to subsidize foster families. But also to not just make foster families an institution, take it on to adoption so we have kids stabilized. Whenever I do custody allocations, I have to look at the solution that most nearly stabilizes children in their lives. It doesn't do them any good to be moving foster family. We need to move on to some kind of permanence. And that's where the subsidized adoption is coming. At least that's my idea. What do I know? I don't know anything.
Yeah. I mean, you would think I had some experience personally, more not with West Virginia, but, we were actually, dealing with the adoption on my family in the D.C. foster care. So now I'm not comparing D.C. and West Virginia. I don't know, West Virginia. Close. But it was a nightmare trying to adopt. And literally on their agenda over there, now again, that's a completely different jurisdiction. Adoption is like number 9 on their list of goals, literally for families. And like we went through the ringer. We didn't succeed in adoption. But it's like the last thing to seem like they wanted. There's all kinds of issues, but all I'm saying is it seemed extremely like they really want people to adopt, really? It doesn't seem like it.
No, and I think that needs to be encouraged too. Now, of course, we're talking about adoption by fit people, not just, like doing puppy mills in veterinarian circles or something like that. We need to get the right people. But I think that's where we got to look at is moving toward permanence rather than temporary solutions.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about on maybe some related issue, but like with the current whole COVID-19 thing, it seems like, throughout the nation, a lot of governors have put different restrictions in place, including Governor Justice. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of constitutional issues, about it. There's so many, it seems like almost you were talking about separation of powers. Well, wow, the governor said, you'll stay home. Don't meet more than 25. Don't meet more than 5. It makes up what I see as relatively random, things like, oh, there's more than 20 cases, you're a hotspot. Oh, oops, we forgot to consider population. No, you're not a hotspot. So all I'm saying is it seems like these issues are ripe for review in the courts or whatever, or by the legislatures. I mean, it seems almost really excessive. Do you have any thoughts on that kind of thing?
Yeah, I sure do. First of all, all that litany of things that you mentioned, there's one thing that you didn't include and was one affected me the most, is moving the election from May 12 to June 9. That is in the statute, okay? And nobody really approved that. Nobody really contested that. As a lawyer, that came to my mind, man, that ought to be, maybe I should file something. Then I got to thinking, well, somebody will make play on that I don't care whether or not poll workers are infected, But I agree with what you're saying there on that particular issue. And then it's even worse than you imagine on the judicial side of it. Since March 12, Richard, we've had 7, count them, 7, like the 7 dwarfs, administrative orders coming out of the West Virginia Supreme Court that were, in a lot of measure, contradictory or general, or just said it's in your good discretion, judges. Secondly, we had the circuit judges in the circuit that I'm in promulgate their rules for reopening. We had the Family Court Association, State of West Virginia, try to promulgate their rules for opening. And it seemed to me like the Supreme Court, too, when this whole thing started, the things you were talking about shutting down, we had the county commission in Kanawha County shut down the judicial annex. And it was probably with good cause because there was the first seven people infected in Kanawha County were out of the judicial annex. But what I'm coming around to saying is it seems like the Supreme Court was always doing catch up to the governor and going along with everything said about closing down courts, basically. And they issued this order. And West Virginia has Article 3, Section 17 of the Constitution. It says the courts of the state of West Virginia shall lie open to its citizens for the redress of their grievances without delay. And let's face it, there's been a lot of delay. Now, I know you have to protect the public and you don't want people, juries and jury boxes that sit within 1 feet of each other. I understand all that. And they've made, and to give the court some credit, they've tried to provide a technical solution to hearings. But it's still, we're still being told as of, I guess it would be the order that came down here last week, that as of May 18th, it's called the May 6th administrative order. Basically, we still shouldn't be holding in-person hearings except in emergency cases. And right now there's being restrictions to the Kanawha County Annex on the 18th of May, just to, for those emergency type hearings. You can't come into the circuit clerk's office, for example, unless you have an appointment.
So are there no no jury trials right now? They're suspended until whenever?
I think it's July 7th. I might be off on that day. It's in July, I know that. And then grand juries are held off to about June 27th. That date I think is correct. I might be off on that. It's in July for the petit juries. And of course, you know, in family law, we don't have juries and ours is confidential. But you know, we have a lot of witnesses that usually show up in custody matters, and we have to deal with that. None of our, you know, I mean, in my courtroom, it would be hard to have two attorneys, two parties, a bailiff, and like in a domestic violence case.
Here we go.
Where did we leave off?
Well, we're talking about the constitutional rights, and you were mentioning about the schedule of the administrative rulings of whether the court would resume or when it will resume and things like that.
Yeah, and the access of citizens. I think that's a big constitutional issue.
Definitely. Yeah, something that I'm personally interested in working on, like, I think, I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on it, like, and if you can talk about in West Virginia, you know, with the, you know, I'm concerned about the constitutional issues, like of the legislature and sometimes their administrative rulings dealing with, you know, like vaccine mandates and things like that. I mean, it seems that that could violate or does constitutional rights, First or Fourth Amendment. I don't know if you're free to say anything about it or have any opinion generally, you know, because that's something that's happening throughout the nation, I think.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to get in trouble, but I don't know.
Don't say anything you shouldn't, but I don't know.
Well, let me just give you a pretty good hint then. How's this? My mother was a school teacher. My partner's a school teacher. I had three kids, and the health of those kids meant everything to me. And I think also the health of kids that they go to school with are important too. So I think you can probably see where I'm going with this.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. I know that might be, you know.
Now, yeah, I will say this. I don't think that's a Fourth Amendment issue. I will say that. It might be another issue, have other implications, but I don't think it's, because you may remember, well, I can say this. You may remember back in the 40s, I mean, not that you were alive or I was alive, either one, but there were a number of cases that came out of West Virginia about the Jehovah Witnesses in West Virginia not wanting to put their children into school and not letting them have, but the big thing was not letting them have medical attention. If a child, you know, was really hurting with a pneumonia, I'm just using this example. There were a number of cases say, well, if I want to trust in God to cure him and not take him to school or not take him to the hospital, that's my right. And there was an attempt to put that under the Fourth Amendment. I think the anti-vaxxers fall within the types of cases that had to be decided with regard to the Jehovah's Witnesses. Those cases went all the way to the United States Supreme Court.
Okay. All right. Fair enough on that. All right, we'll leave it at that for now. But yeah, those are important issues. Or some, it does kind of segue with the constitutional issues, I think, because there's idea of like health freedom, you know, who's to decide what things you have to mandatorily do or not do. Those are big issues, you know.
Yeah, and on the other side, that's public policy. Public policy is a protection for the greater good. So you have to balance those things. You know, I mean, it's there's no absolute on any constitutional amendment, even on the most powerful First Amendment about freedom of speech. There is substantial law, and I think there's a reason for the law. You can not restrict somebody's expression, but when it gets to the point of like yelling fire in a crowded theater just to watch people get hurt, that's not freedom of expression. That, you know, that falls against public policy. But to be able to limit those freedoms, there has to be a compelling state interest and something and some restriction, some prior restraint that doesn't penalize the exercise of that. So I don't know, I'm probably not being articulate in expressing that, but that's the way I see it. If you're going to restrict the amendment, there has to be a public policy compelling reason to do so.
Right, and that does have some segue with the whole thing of like the governor, you know, making a lot of regulations supposed to be in the greater good, and then quote unquote based on science, or is it, you know what I mean? There's a lot of questions there.
Well, especially on the election, they spent so much time prior to April 1, that's when he continued it to June 9. Prior to April 1, they spent so much time ostensibly with the Secretary of State, with the approval of the governor, saying, all right, we're going to have the election. We're going to just make it an almost all absentee election. You know, maybe if we can relax standards by May 12, we can do it. And I'd actually gotten the ballot application in the mail myself. They sent it to everybody that could walk or couldn't walk. They sent it to everybody that had an address. And then they turn around and say, and I think some people even filled them out between the time, like, I think it was March 26th, and some of those applications came out in April 1 and sent them in, and it's led to a great deal of confusion. Mm-hmm. I think when you're going to say from the executive branch and the Board of Public Works, and we're going to have an election, we're going to do it by absentee, and then switch in midstream to do that, it smacks to me of a political decision in a way. Isn't it better for some gubernatorial candidates to prolong crises, to look like leaders, to get all that free publicity? I'm just asking a question.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point. I mean, that's a pretty legit question, definitely. Yeah, well, just kind of to move things maybe toward a conclusion, like, okay. I know you're running against three other candidates in, Division 2. How would you, like, differentiate yourself from the other candidates? Would you care to share anything about that?
Sure. First of all, as I said earlier, I'm the only one of the candidates that has substantial family law experience. I am the only one of the candidates in that division that has had and is currently a family court judge experience. I'm the family court judge. And that's what we need on the Supreme Court. That's the first differentiation. And then my experience in practice of law has been more on the boots on the ground practical experience. One other in that division has practical experience, but I've not been a circuit judge. There's I know that's popular to say in my division, well, I've been a circuit judge as if that's an automatic entitlement. I know that at least one other person in the division said, well, I've been a circuit judge and all these other people came into my race late. So that shows they're not committed. Well, I didn't understand that these divisions belonged to anybody. I thought anybody could get into it. And I thought that was pretty provincial and narrow attitude to be taking. And then on the other end of it, I'm not a former legislator. So, and although I have been a former prosecutor, but I think just the breadth of my experience, I've never been a member of a big law firm. I've never been in a law firm that's a captive insurance firm or a personal injury firm. I've never been in a big firm. And I think where it really differentiates me, Richard, is I understand two things. I understand people. As I think as people sit around their kitchen table in Harper's Ferry or Shenandoah or those areas, drinking their coffee, their Maxwell House coffee, they're not concerned about whether or not one little county in Virginia wants to join West Virginia. They're not concerned about intermediate appellate court. They're not concerned about mass litigation. they are concerned about whether or not, as a grandparent, they're going to get to see that little grandchild, whether a single working mother is going to get her child support, whether the father has two boys or something, and his ex-wife wants to move those kids from Jefferson County to the state of Oregon, whether or not he's going to get to see them. A domestic violence victim that's been battered, male or female, they're worried about what their next move is. Where are they going to live? Are they going to file for divorce? Can they afford to? Can they afford to feed the kids? How are they going to get out? How does this virus affect them? This is what I call my kitchen table campaign. I have a kitchen table campaign that people sit around the kitchen table. I know what they are thinking. And then the last thing that differentiates me, I've not sought any endorsements from anybody. I have filled out their questionnaires. I've done at least one interview. But my position is on those endorsements, somebody starts saying all these endorsements, is you have to wonder, as an average voter, what did they cost? How are they going to be paid for in the future? And don't you think these special interests don't expect payment? Look what happened to Justice Hutchison, who had labor endorsements, and the minute he went with the majority and agreed that the right to work was constitutional, all these labor unions pulled their endorsements. They expected his vote. Now, there's at least one other candidate, well, there's two, that say that they've got endorsements of all these people, and the Republican Executive Committee, Chamber of Commerce, and labor unions. I don't want to say that. I'm independent. I'm my own person. And those people, you know, I think the voters are justified in saying, if I get on the other side of somebody from, say, like the AFL-CIO in a claim, and this particular justice has got an AFL-CIO endorsement got there, am I going to be treated fairly? Is that justice going to be impartial? And those endorsements, they say they can pull them out if you don't vote right. That's what they did to Justice Hutchison. He's not in my division. That's what they did to him. So that's what distinguishes me. It's my independence. But again, I still come back to my mantra on my kitchen table campaign is that for those people that have those issues sitting around their kitchen table drinking their coffee, you need me on the Supreme Court, because not only have I been a father or grandfather and been divorced, I've walked in their shoes. I can sit on their case. Wouldn't you, if you had a grandparent visitation or LGBTQ issue or a relocation issue, wouldn't you want somebody on the Supreme Court that's had those experiences? To me, it's analogous if you were going to go in to have your appendix removed, have an appendectomy. Do you want a board certified physician, or do you want a third year medical student that's got about 30 pages yet to read in the anatomy book yet?
Right. Okay. That's a good point. All right.
That's it. So that's what makes me different besides my passion. I've really become inflamed with the righteousness of the cause here, and then maybe it's a lost cause, but don't you fight harder for lost causes than any other?
Yeah, no, I appreciate you coming on, and you know, people will watch the interview and other candidates, you know, interviews, and you know, be able to be well informed. So I do really thank you. Did you want to say any else in closing about your candidacy?
Well, first of all, I thank you for being interested enough to contact me. But again, what I want to do to the Supreme Court is bring practical experience. I want to renew an allegiance to the predictability function of law. In other words, you follow precedents. I think we ought to, I want to bring into the Supreme Court too, to an effort to lessen the spatial and geographical distance. I don't see why the Supreme Court, they have set argument sessions at the College of Law. They have had them in Huntington recently, and you know, I can't see why they can't go to the 55 counties. I can't see why, you know, we can't come to Charlestown in the Supreme Court there.
It's interesting. I was reading that from 1885 or something to 1935 or something, that they had to meet here in Charlestown. I didn't know that. I guess you
knew they've met. That. Well, yeah, some of those were hot political issues, by the way, and then they brought it up there. I remember in some of the mine war cases out of the 50s, they took them out and they took them up to Charlestown, one out of Clay County in particular, in central part of the state. So why can't the Supreme Court hold documents You know, right now I know a bunch of attorneys that don't even know, you know, what division, what somebody's running in, let alone the public. The public, you know, they don't think about the Supreme Court. And Richard, here's, I guess, one of my final things about this spatial distance is these are 2 12-year terms on the table, plus 1 4-year term. Now, that's going to set the law for the next decade plus in the state of West Virginia. And yeah. I think the least they can do is people know who their justices are, and we could hold court, take arguments. I was in one at the College of Law front of the court. In fact, that very case I was talking to you about, that Clifford K case. And we had, I think they argued 4 cases up there, and each of the courthouses are equipped. My God, in Jefferson County, that's the most historical courthouse in the state. That was the site of the, you know, the John Brown trial.
Right.
And it's one of the oldest ones. And why can't we hold argument, you know, 12-year term, we ought to be able to hold court in every county of the state. But still, I think the media, you and everyone that's interviewed me, they should be impressing upon people, your neighbor, your paper boy, the veterinarian for your dog. These are 2 12-year terms that will set the law. And if you don't have a family court judge on there for the next 12 years, again, I think the state will be at a loss. It'll be a loss to be felt and there'll be nothing done about it. It can be done with the 12-year term unless somebody's impeached. And that's only happened once.
Right.
Anyway, I don't know. When you invited me to ask the question, just everybody should remember family law touches everyone, and I'm the most qualified to do that. And I'm not owned by anybody, and I'm not endorsed by anybody.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jim Douglas, for coming on and, you know, letting everybody know, you know, clearly where you stand and why, you know, they should vote for you. I appreciate that. We'll, you know, make this available so hopefully many people will watch it. And, yeah, so I am your host, Richard Urban, coming to Historic Harpers Ferry. Thank you very much for watching today, and we'll see you next time.